vaping in New York. As the country faces what's becoming a nationwide health crisis, will New York ban flavored vaping products? How does tackle football affect young kids' brains? We'll also have analysis of the week's headlines on the Reporters' Roundtable. We'll talk to Jimmy Vielkind of The Wall Street Journal and Dan Clark of The New York Law Journal. I'm Ray Suarez, and this is New York Now.
Funding for New York Now is provided by WNET. Winner of a New York State Emmy for Best Political Program, this is New York Now.
Welcome to New York Now. I'm Ray Suarez. Here's a look at the latest headlines in state government. President Trump is no longer a New Yorker. Governor Andrew Cuomo's response? Good riddance. In a tweet Thursday, the governor said, quote, "It's not like Trump paid taxes here anyway. He's all yours, Florida." Prisoners in New York would get the right to vote under a new bill introduced in the state legislature this week. Brooklyn State Senator Kevin Parker says it's meant to fight felony disenfranchisement, which affects predominantly Black and Latino prisoners. The proposal was met with harsh criticism from Republican lawmakers, and Governor Cuomo said in an interview earlier this year he would not support the idea. New York's top election official is proposing a new office to oversee public campaign finance. Risa Sugarman proposed a state office of election law enforcement. That came during a meeting of the Public Finance Commission this week. And it comes as a 9-member commission works to iron out a statewide system due by December 1st. Meanwhile, the State Board of Elections says so far 100,000 New Yorkers have voted early. The state's first ever early voting period ends November 3rd. And New York lawmakers may be considering a ban on tackle football before age 12. A recent nationwide campaign compared the risks of playing tackle football at a tender age to smoking. It pointed to a new study out of Boston University. The study says the risk of developing the degenerative brain disease CTE rises exponentially the younger you start tackling. With me now is Angela Harrison. She's on the board of directors of the Concussion Legacy Foundation and one of the driving forces behind their Tackle Can Wait campaign. Welcome to the program.
Hi there.
Why age 12? What's happening in the bodies of boys that you've decided to put a boundary there?
12 is not a magic number. I mean, what we know is the younger you start, when these brains are forming, the injuries that happen in their head at that time, they can be a lot worse and they can have more of an impact. So the ultimate goal of the Tackle Can Wait campaign is just to minimize the numbers of years that people are spending playing tackle football. Because right now, with people starting at age 5, kids starting that young, it gives a lot more runway for damage to compound over time. So what we want to do for most people is minimize those years to maybe 4 or 5 years of playing tackle football, which is going to significantly reduce the risk of them developing CTE down the line.
But even at boys that age, there's a wide diversity in the size, in the weight, in the speed. You could have a little guy lining up against a guy who's already hitting puberty and is pretty big.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of, it's a lose-lose for everybody. If you're a little kid, you're getting knocked around. If you're the big kid, you're spending more time hitting. So everybody's kind of, bearing the brunt of tackling for that extended period of time. So the best thing to do is probably play flag until you're a little bit older.
Since the news started to come out and the public awareness started to grow about what NFL players were finding in their 40s, 50s, even earlier, there's been a certain amount of change. A certain number of parents have said, I don't think I want my kid to play high contact sports like tackle football. Mm-hmm. But still, a majority of parents say they would let their children play. What do you say to them?
I say you should probably read the new study that just came out in the Annals of Neurology that says that the risk of developing CTE goes up 30% for each year that you play. And that's regardless of level. That's peewee, that's high school, that's college, it's NFL. They were all basically weighted the same in this study. So every year that risk goes up by 30%, and that's compounded over time. And this is a new study. Right, and we're making some new comparisons in the PSA that we worked on. We're hoping that we can maybe obviously shock people into hearing this number now because the CTE conversation is not new. But what is new is the shift in the conversation from concussions to repeated blows over time that compound, and the real risk being in kind of these invisible hits or subconcussive blows.
Now, that's an important part of this whole conversation because coaches who coach boys, not adults, say they are trying to have the game played in a way that involves less helmet-to-helmet contact, not valorizing hard hits in the same way. Isn't that enough?
No.
Lowering the contact?
No. I mean, there's really no safe way to hit your head, with or without a helmet. Helmets were designed to stop skull fractures. They were put on players back in the day so that they would stop people from cracking their head open on the field. They were made for more surface injuries. There's no helmet that can really stop your brain from moving around inside your skull. And there's no pain sensors in there, so you don't know. You don't feel your brain rattling around inside your head, for good or for bad. I mean, here in this situation with tackle football and kids, I would say for the worse, because they're just going to keep hitting their heads over and over.
What kind of reception have you gotten in the legislature? People like football. It's the most popular sport in America. And they are not against, as I've mentioned, having their kids play.
Yeah. I mean, I've testified in two hearings, one in Boston last week, and then I was in New York City this week. I would say New York City was a lot more welcoming. It's tough. People don't want to hear it. People don't want to think that this game that they have grown up loving could cause so much damage. But, you know, the science is becoming undeniable. So at some point, I'm hoping now with this new data, and the PSA that we created, this is going to be the shift where people start to put their kids into flag football and wait and minimize those years that they're tackling.
So you can make a lot of progress using a voluntary standard. But for your organization, Tackle Can Wait, is the goal really a law, a limit, a rule in place among the schools of New York State?
I would say yes. I mean, it took a long time for people to understand why we needed seatbelts, why we needed to have laws against smoking, you know, or that minors are smoking or drinking and all of these things. Like, it takes a while for that to happen. So this is not, kind of like you said in the beginning, an overnight sort of change. But I'm hoping this paper that just came out is a real pivot point that we're going to be able to look back at and say, this is when it started to click. This is when people started to really understand the risks.
The use of that very, very graphic picture of little kids lighting up and taking a puff of cigarettes, this highlights the role of parents, because we're leaving it up to parents to decide whether or not their sons play. But it's against the law to decide that a 16-year-old or a 14-year-old, or certainly a 12-year-old, can smoke or drink or drive a car. We do have rules that are age-based.
Yeah. I mean, and that's why I'm here, right? I mean, like, this is why we're having this conversation, is because we kind of had to come out of the gate swinging a little bit. But, I mean, a lot of the conversation, if you listen to the hearings that are available online from New York City, it's, you know, you don't give a kid car keys at 10 or 11 just because you think that maybe they can drive or you teach them to drive. Their brains are not formed in a way where they can make those kinds of decisions. So what we're trying to do is say that same kind of brain that you wouldn't trust to drink or drive or smoke is not a brain that you should be trusting to protect itself. You're putting a lot of onus on the children when you're saying that the way that we teach them to tackle, it's up to them to protect their brains. These are little kids.
Angela Harrison of Tackle Can Wait, thanks a lot. We'll talk more about banning tackle football in New York during the Reporters Roundtable coming up later in the program. Now let's look at vaping. It's at the center of a health crisis unfolding in New York and across the country. Governor Andrew Cuomo banned the sale of flavored vaping products in September. That ban came after the death of a Bronx teenager from an alleged vaping-related illness. Across the country, there have been 1,600 illnesses and 35 deaths so far. Other states have banned vaping in various ways as well, but New York's ban is on hold. Vaping industry advocates filed an injunction in state court this month. A judge granted it. The issue is tied up in the state Supreme Court. So the future of vaping in New York is unclear. Here's a look at how it's affecting the state.
Good afternoon.
Governor Cuomo's recommendation against vaping earlier this year was simple.
If you don't know what it is that you are smoking, don't smoke it.
Last month, Cuomo, with State Health Commissioner Howard Zucker, issued an executive order banning the sale of flavored vaping products.
What we're saying here is we don't know what a lot of these substances are, and you have an alarming rate of illness.
Cuomo's ban came after the death of a teenager in the Bronx and amid sobering statistics from the State Health Department.
High school use in 2018 was 27.4%. which is 160% higher than it was in 2014. The flavoring is a key youth marketing strategy of the vaping aerosol industry, just as it is in the cigarette and the cigar and the smokeless tobacco markets. And these flavorant chemicals used in the e-cigarettes have been approved by the FDA for ingestion, but not for inhalation.
The ban was put on hold when vaping industry advocates filed an injunction at the 11th hour. In addition to fearing for their businesses, they warn that restricting vaping may drive smokers back to cigarettes. As suspected vaping-related illness and deaths rise around the country, doctors and researchers are racing to better understand its effects.
One of the problems is that it's very difficult to tell that somebody has a vaping-related disease.
Dr. Harold Sokol is a pulmonologist in Albany. He's seen a few cases of vaping-related illness recently.
My particular case was a gentleman that had been vaping. He called it synthetic marijuana. And basically, it took him about a couple of months. He then started losing weight, developing chills and fevers, et cetera. He came into the hospital. The original hospitalists, who are not familiar with this, because this is also new, thought this was a standard, what's called a community-acquired pneumonia, treated him with antibiotics, and when he was not getting better, in fact, getting worse, we got called. I asked him, was he vaping? And he said, yes, I was. And I started treating him with intravenous steroids, which are an anti-inflammatory. Now, there are no studies to show the intravenous steroids work because we haven't had enough time to do studies. However, many of these cases do respond. He did. He went home. He's been back about 3 weeks later in my office. His x-ray is significantly better, especially his CAT scan. And he knows he better not use the stuff again.
According to the latest data from the CDC, most of the patients who presented with vaping-related illnesses across the country had vaped using products containing THC. THC is the primary psychoactive component of marijuana. It is not known how this may have contributed to the illnesses. However, the CDC is warning people not to vape with products containing THC.
How the vaping crisis will affect medical cannabis is not known. The CDC's data points to THC acquired through, quote, informal sources, not licensed medical marijuana dispensaries. According to the State Department of Health, there have been no reported illnesses associated with medical marijuana vaping products. Dispensaries across New York are trying to get ahead of any potential stigma. One dispensary in New York's Hudson Valley is now offering another option.
What we have are ground flower pods. So it's cannabis flower that's been cured for 30 days, trimmed and ground and placed into a pod so patients can vaporize it and use the actual flower product with minimal processing. It's tested by the state to be pesticide-free, mold-free, fungus-free, heavy metal-free. So when we look at patients who are self-medicating on the illicit market, we offer a safer, more consistent product that's been tested by the state and that they can come in and purchase legally through a regulated program and receive medical advice.
Woodcock says the company is looking forward to working with legislators next year. Meanwhile, physicians like Harold Sokol are focused on prevention of vaping-related illness.
I would hope that with all the information that's being given, that people will be more aware of it and people will be more circumspect in what they're putting in their airways. And I'm not suggesting any one particular product, but anything you breathe in may be a problem.
The fate of the statewide ban on flavored vaping products remains uncertain. A recent Siena College poll suggests a majority of New Yorkers favor the ban. A state Supreme Court is expected to rule on whether to go forward with the ban.
It's time to discuss the news of the week with the Reporters Roundtable. With me is Jimmy Vielkind of the Wall Street Journal and Dan Clark of the New York Law Journal. And gentlemen, obviously the big story of the week nationwide, approval of the rule for proceeding with the impeachment inquiry on Capitol Hill. Jimmy, were there any surprises in the New York delegation?
No, there was some uncertainty about Representative Anthony Brindisi, Democrat who represents the 22nd District, which stretches through Utica all the way down to Binghamton. He was of the four frontline Democrats in the state, that is, Democrats who were elected in 2018, but whose districts were carried by Donald Trump in 2016. He was the only one who had not said that he supported an impeachment inquiry. And Brindisi is really taking it from both sides. I covered a town hall event in his district 2 weeks ago. You had Trump supporters who were angry with him for having Democrats at all being involved in an impeachment inquiry. And then you had some Democratic progressive left activists in the same room saying that if he didn't support an impeachment inquiry, what was the point of sending him to Congress? So his vote was something that I was watching for. I guess I wouldn't have been surprised either way. But expect that to be an issue in his reelection campaign, which is shaping up as a rematch between him and former Congresswoman Claudia Tenney, who he defeated in 2018.
I am interested to see where he goes with that, whether he takes the impeachment vote now that he's on the record with it, and he puts it out there for the campaign and says that that's something to support him for, or if he kind of shies away from it as something that it might look bad for him to potential voters.
Well, does he get to play sort of the soft option here and see how this vote went down? This was just on the rule. This was not a vote for the impeachment of Donald Trump. Does he get to see how this plays before figuring out how to proceed?
He could use the same excuse again as saying, well, this is my vote to learn more, rather than this is not my vote for impeachment of the president, this is my vote to learn more. And he could frame that as the responsible option as a member of Congress. He just wants to learn more as to whether he's going to vote in the future to impeach the president, not that he's actually doing it now.
Well, stay tuned. I mean, obviously, there's a lot of chapters left to play. From Senator Kevin Parker of Brooklyn, we get the proposal to allow prisoners in New York State prisons to vote. Dan Clark, is New York similar to most states, distinct from most states in this regard?
Same for most states in this regard. So prisoners in New York cannot vote currently. The bill from Kevin Parker would make it so that they could vote. The interesting part of this bill is that they wouldn't be voting in the district that the prison is in. They would be essentially doing an absentee ballot and voting in the county that they resided in before they actually went to prison. So I hate to be a fortune teller, but I would say that this bill will almost never pass in the New York State Legislature. And if it does, Governor Andrew Cuomo already said earlier this year or later last year, I can't remember, that he doesn't support this idea. So we could very easily see a veto on it in the future.
Jimmy, New York is not one of the states that has made it hard for people who have prison in their past to vote. Is this just a bridge too far for a lot of politicians in Albany, that while you're currently serving your time, you'd be able to go into a ballot box?
I think that Republican State Chairman Nick Langworthy heard this news, went home, said three Hail Marys and an Our Father, and immediately looked for manna to fall from heaven, because that's what this is. I think Republicans are immediately leaping to attack this proposal. And it once again shows tension within the Democratic Party between members mostly from New York City who are more liberal, more progressive, and moderate members who helped propel their party to control the state Senate majority this year for the first time in a decade. So allowing inmates in prison to vote is fine for Senator Parker. He represents a district in Brooklyn. But if you're a moderate member on Long Island, if you're a moderate member in the Hudson Valley, seats that the Democrats need to hold in the 2020 election cycle, this is not something that you're going to be keen on supporting, and you'd rather see the issue go away entirely.
Yeah, I was going to say this is definitely almost guaranteed to be a non-starter for senators on Long Island, like Todd Kominsky, for example, who was hesitant to support the bail reform, criminal justice reforms. This issue is not going to be any different for them.
Well, Dan, let me continue with you. This has been a busy time in the state's highest court, the Court of Appeals. They've been busy hearing some big cases. Tell us what's going on.
Yeah, so there are a lot of cases on their docket right now. We're nearing the end of the year. That means this is crunch time. They have to get everything done. One case that's of particular interest to me right now is one out of Buffalo. The residents in Buffalo probably know about this. Officer Corey Krug of the Buffalo Police Department was caught on video using excessive force, basically, against somebody outside of a bar in Buffalo on Thanksgiving Eve a couple years ago. He was charged by federal prosecutors over civil rights charges in that case. And at the same time, the man that he allegedly assaulted sued him over personal damages, things like that, over the incident, since it was aired over the news and everybody knew his identity and things like that. The city of Buffalo said, "We have the video here and you've been charged by federal prosecutors, so we're not going to provide an attorney for you. We're not going to front your legal defense and we're not going to cover any damages that come from that lawsuit." So Corey Krug, the Buffalo police officer, sued the city of Buffalo to try to get them, force them to provide legal defense for him. That case has been ongoing for a couple years now, made it to the state's highest court this month. They're going to issue a decision on that next month.
It's interesting that the FOP or the PBA, I don't know which applies in Buffalo's case, wouldn't immediately just sidle in next to a defendant and it's not really an issue.
Right. Well, I don't know if they have the same resources as the city necessarily. And I think that if they did that, I think that it would almost look bad for the city. What they want ultimately is for the city to say that Corey Krug was doing the right thing when he attacked that man on that night.
Any other big cases?
There are a few. They're a little bit technical in nature. I don't want to get too into the weeds on it. There was a really big decision this month about housing and rent in New York City. So a group of tenants, about two dozen of them, brought this big class action lawsuit against their landlord, which actually owns four buildings that they all live in. They were suing them over rent overcharges, but for very different reasons. The court ruled this month that they can file that class action lawsuit over this underlying scheme that they overcharged them, even though they had all these different reasons for it. That's a very interesting case going forward, and it's going to open a lot of doors in New York City for tenants to join together with these big landlords that own a lot of buildings and sue them over rent overcharges.
And make potential to make law in the rest of the state.
Absolutely.
Right?
That's what the state's highest court does very often. They change the law, they interpret it in certain ways that it hasn't been interpreted before. It's arguably as powerful as the legislature.
Jimmy, what's going on with criminal justice reform in the state? People talk about it a lot. They refer to it a lot. They use it as a catch-all phrase. But there's real action going on right now and some serious questions that have to be answered.
There is. What's happening now is after legislative action this year and in previous cycles, laws are coming on the books. So one element of particular concern, and which was the subject of a recent hearing, was discovery reform, a new law which will mandate that district attorneys, prosecutors have to share all evidence against the potential or against a defendant with the defense attorneys relatively quickly after they've been charged. So prosecutors are already saying this is going to be very difficult to implement. We don't have the resources to do it. Here in the Capital District, one very high profile trial, that of Nauman Hussein, who's charged with criminally negligent homicide in connection with last year's crash in Schoharie County that killed 20 people. The district attorney postponed a planned start date on a few days after the new year, recognizing that there would be new demands regarding sharing evidence.
So now, there are a lot of people who just watched the second half of Law and Order episodes, and they're thinking, wait a minute, don't you already have to share all this? Why is this such a big change, this discovery formula?
So there's nothing on the books right now that says that prosecutors have to hand over the information immediately. There is no real set schedule on the books right now. So what happens in some criminal cases is that somebody's charged and they're kept in jail, pretrial incarceration for many months, sometimes years. And during that time, the prosecutor does not have to give their defense attorney information that could possibly exonerate them. So in some cases, prosecutors actually wait until days or weeks before the trial to give that information to the defendant. What this law does is it requires prosecutors to give that information to the defendant 15 days after an arraignment or soon after, depending on how it's laid out and things like that. So it's the first time that the state is enacting this reform to make sure that defendants have the information to build a proper defense to get themselves exonerated or at least diminish the charges.
The other concern that's come up is about witnesses. Prosecutors say this will make it much harder to get people to come forward and testify if they have to be out in the open for so long.
Quick look at tackle football. It seems like this is one that people who don't pay attention to much that goes on in Albany will be watching very closely.
I didn't even know this was an issue, to be honest with you. I didn't know that kids under 12 play tackle football, but then again, I don't really watch children's sports.
Children's sports, man. It's been a divisive issue. There's a bill by Assemblyman Michael Benedetto from the Bronx that would ban children under 12 from playing. And of course, people who watch the NFL know that head injuries are a concern, the long-term effects in the disease CTE are the concern. During this hearing, an official from USA Football testified that there are more kids playing flag football than there are tackle football right now. So the trend is clearly going that way. The question is whether there should be a law on the books.
Well, gentlemen, thanks a lot, and thanks for giving us this update from Albany. Dan Clark, Jimmy Vilkind, good to talk to you.
Thanks.
You.
To learn more about what we covered on tonight's show, head over to New York Now's website at nynow.org. And join us next week. We'll be talking about a controversial New York State civil rights law that protects police records. Lawmakers may consider repealing it come January. We'll speak to advocates on both sides of the issue. I'm Ray Suarez. This is New York Now.